Welcome to What She Said. I'm your host, Lucy Lucroft, a freelance journalist and blogger from London. Each week, I chat to awesome humans about their journey to where they are today, and we share lots of blogging tips and tricks too. You can hear the entire back catalogue, as well as new episodes wherever you listen to podcasts by searching for my name, or searching What She Said, or you can go to my website, wanderloose.com. And if you want to come say hi online, I'm at Lucy Lucroft on Instagram or Twitter, or over at my blog, wanderloose.com. Enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to What She Said. I'm your host, Lucy Lucroft, and you're listening to Series 2, Episode 14. This week, I chat with Kate of A Playful Day about the strange twists and turns our careers can take, and how staying playful is important in this crazy online world we're all in. She opened up about the challenges of being a single mum, right through to where she is today in a super positive space up in Edinburgh after her online gap year. I said year, like in such a posh way there. Yeah. Anyway, if you need to hear that it's all going to be okay and that you can achieve amazing things without following the rules, this is the episode for you. Hello and welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm very good. How are you?
Really well, thank you.
Good.
So for anybody that doesn't know who you are, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your blogging journey so far?
Oh, okay. So I'm Kate. So it's a tricky one.
It's a big question.
But I'm Kate and I blog and podcast and share all kinds of things on social media and online as A Playful Day. And the kind of story behind why I chose A Playful Day is I was in a place where I felt like I needed a playful moment in every day, like a reminder to kind of be inspired and let go of some things. And I was in a job I didn't particularly like. I did a lot of work in like mental health and behavioral services and special needs schools and often quite deprived areas, which I loved, but the paperwork and the commuting and everything around it was just, it was knocking the stuffing out of me, I think is the best way to put it. So I set up this kind of blog because I was having these long commutes and I was consuming blogs and podcasts at such a rate that I just felt like I really wanted to join in that conversation. And at the time I hadn't really been using my camera very much, whereas when I was younger, sort of in my sort of actually even pre-teens, I was really into photography and creative writing, and I did drama and writing at university, and I went traveling and with my camera, and then I just kind of stopped and put all that creative stuff aside and focused on work really. And so I saw the blog as a really good opportunity to pick my camera up again and take a photograph every day, or to write every day, or to try recipes out and just really be part of that really creative online space that was kind of exploding, I guess, because it was, yeah. I'm trying to think how long I've been blogging for. It must be maybe 6-7 years, I guess. And before that there was, you know, the usual Flickr route that I think a lot of people usually mention, especially if they like photographs. Like Flickr was amazingly inspirational, and I came in at the sort of when everyone was seemed really to know what they were doing on Flickr. I was quite intimidated in this really awe-inspired way. The blog kind of came there, and then I did a creativity challenge and decided to do a podcast episode as part of it, because there was lots of kind of blog-alongs and link-ups and things. It was very much that kind of era of blogging. And I had such a positive response. I thought, I might do this again. I really like just switching on a microphone because people talk back to you a lot more.
Really nice. They do, actually. That's a really good point about podcasts.
People tend to like, and my favourite is when people kind of live tweet when they're listening. Which I love it if I happen to be on Twitter when they're doing, because then it is like a conversation as they're listening, and which always makes me laugh. But if I come back later, I'm like, oh, I'm sorry I wasn't there for that moment. But yeah, it just kind of, it grew from there really. And people got really interested in the way that I go about telling stories and the way I sort of really try and engage with communities. And I've changed focus a few times with what A Playful Day is about. But at its core, it's kind of always creative in some way and about just taking a moment to just reflect, whether it's been on family life, on, you know, something that means quite a lot to me and can be quite personal, or whether it's, you know, I really enjoyed this recipe. It's a nice way to work and share, I think. Yeah. And from that, I actually completely changed career and I'm no longer completely burnt out and things, which is kind of an amazing opportunity. And when people sort of, I guess, are a bit sniffy about bloggers,
yeah,
as a professional bloggers, and like, it changed my life. And I can say that hand on heart. Thanks to Instagram, I moved to a beautiful rural thatched cottage in on the south coast. And actually, thanks to my blogging and podcasting life, I met my now girlfriend, who I've now moved to Edinburgh and live with. You know, it's really changed my life, and it's changed my work life and my personal life. And I love that creativity. And I know that it can be difficult. There are difficult elements of it for people, and I'm very respectful of that. But I'm very much in the pro camp.
Yeah. I think that's great. And when you were talking about your journey, it suddenly struck me that Siobhan Watts from Bless the Weather, who was on mm-hmm. episode 3 in series 1. She had a similar route to you in that she had done photography as a teenager. That was her passion. And then she put it aside and did her job and then went back to it. And I find that so interesting how our education, like, I get so passionate about this, that our education system sets us up to believe that creativity and careers are almost two separate things. Yeah. And that you can't do, the two can never be intertwined.
Unless
you're an artist.
Oh, and then you have to be an incredibly high standard,
yes,
of artist. You know, you have to be someone that, there was always that person in your class that they were the artistic one.
Yes.
Like, it's just a, something like this mythical unicorn, yeah, quality that, like, those are the only ones. And then it's, you know, you have this idea, this sort of tortured soul in a big studio painting on an easel. And that's, in fact, I work in the creative industries now, and sure, there's plenty of tortured souls. There probably are some big windows and some easels in there somewhere, but you know, that's kind of not what it actually looks like. And you have to be pretty creative to be a mathematician or a scientist. You know, I have a 5-year-old right now who's really into robots and programming and science, and she just, watching how she attacks, you know, any kind of problem solving or learning is fascinating, because she does it with such creativity. She loves drawing and she loves art and she loves running. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be a curriculum area that she's particularly, or a learning area, I hate calling it curriculum area, that she's not passionate about. And I was like, when do we kill that? When do we kill that in ourselves, that we think, this is not for me and I have to put it to one side? And that's something that I feel particularly concerned about, and I think has really been such a plus point of moving to Scotland, because it's a different schooling system. Is we're containing children to, you are going to school to prepare for work.
Yeah.
And they're not. They're going to school to prepare for life.
Yeah.
It's a life skill. And I think, had someone said to me, you will be paid to write one day,
yeah,
it wouldn't have occurred to me that that was abnormal at the age of 9. But somewhere along the way, that's not the message I got. So I stopped. I stopped pursuing that.
It's so sad, isn't it? Have you listened to the TED Talk, Sir Ken Robinson? It's like the most popular TED Talk of all time, I think.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God, you would love it. You would absolutely love it. He's amazing. He's so funny. He's like an educationalist, I guess. And the TED Talk is about how schools kill our creativity. And can you imagine if Shakespeare was in our current school right now? And like, do you know what I mean? Like, imagine all of these things, and we're just saying, well, no, we've put you to the careers advisor, and you've inputted this, this, and this, and actually, you're going to be a recruitment consultant or whatever.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I think there is something really valid in. I was reading something on The Pool recently, and I'm terrible with names. I have a really, really bad memory, so I'll have to make sure I get the links with people, but. I tweeted it up, actually, it got a really big response. It was somebody who had been incredibly successful online, and he was all very much about mapping out people's journey and creativity and celebrating that, and very entrepreneurial way, and often the way, you know, and because he's a man, he's speaking all over the world and everyone listens to him, because, you know, men earn great deals of money when they do this online. We can get into that for days. But, something that he then said is that, but there is an awful lot of failure, and there is an awful lot of people who are not getting paid what they're worth, and it's hard, and the hours it takes to put in, and it's, yes, you are living the dream, but your dream might exhaust you.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting point of, I think there's quite a thing at the moment, I think, particularly for sort of creators online who may be offering sort of e-courses and coaching and things, is this sort of message is follow your dreams, yeah, and catch the unicorn, and whatever the meme is that we're creating, or Monday motivation. And I think the very real side that I guess often happens in those one-to-one sessions and doing the course is, this is hard work, and you have to treat it like a business.
Yeah.
And that's something I can't think when I was learned that at school. I don't think I learned how to be a freelancer at school. I did it by making an awful lot of mistakes as an adult.
That's the reality of it, isn't it?
This is how you run a business. Okay. And so now I treat my blog and my podcast and my freelance work very much like a business, and I'm having fun with it, and I feel incredibly lucky to be doing it. But I worked hard for it. It's an interesting thing that I often, and I wonder, because my daughter is now in a household with two women who are self-employed, and one owns a very successful business, and I'm sort of freelancing all the time, and we work in a quite different way to how my family looked. You went out to work and you came back at a certain time, and you earned this amount, and you paid your mortgage, and it doesn't quite work the same when you have a self-employed family. The hours are a bit erratic, and you have to go and pick up a prop and stick it in the back of the car, and all this kind of stuff going on. And she'll be playing, and I'll be like, stand still, that's the perfect light, I need a picture of myself. That's a very normal thing in our house. And so I wonder, if she's getting the stuff that maybe I lacked at school. I'm kind of curious to see where this little scientist in this creative household turns out,
Yeah, and how wonderful for her to have two strong female role models that she can directly see. She won't even think about it as she grows up. She'll just know that, if I want to do that, I can do that. But actually, maybe I want to do something different.
And I hope she kind of keeps that, because I think most kids have that. It's like an innate thing. Like, it doesn't occur to them that failure is an option.
Yeah.
Unless it's, they're trying to learn to ride a bike. And, my daughter is very much, she was the same with everything. Like, she didn't learn to walk till she could walk. So she didn't do the sort of tottering. She just got up and walked one day. Okay, we're walking. And she did the same with talking. And there were certain words. Like, she has an incredibly rich vocabulary. She's always been very interested and engaged with sort of conversations. She likes being in the sling because she was much more at our level. But she didn't use any word until she could use it. So I didn't get too many of the delightful mispronunciations that I got from kids. We got aminals, which I held on to for a long time, and sometimes I would reinforce because I'm cruel. It's one of the few I got. But I kind of, one thing that I love is that it doesn't occur to her that some things aren't for girls and for boys. Mm. It sort of, she hasn't got that message. And when she comes across it, her previous school was quite conservative in a lot of ways. Mm. And she found it really odd when people try to define gender in front of her in terms of what you can and can't achieve. And there was a group of boys who, boys are bigger and better. She's like, no, you're not better, you're just different. And she couldn't understand why this conversation was happening. So I'm kind of curious to see how long she holds that for.
Because my nephew, who is almost six, we noticed a very steep change when he went to primary school, that suddenly little kind of bits of sexist rhetoric crept into his vocabulary. Not that he was saying girls are I guess he kind of was like, girls can't play this with me. And he would say, I want to play with Uncle Ollie, who's my husband, not Auntie Lucy. Auntie Lucy can't do this.
Yeah.
And I remember me and my mum challenging him on this, and he just didn't understand. It's so innocent. But that's been fed to him. Really,
and what a huge
weight
to put on little shoulders. That's what I always think. In that scenario where my daughter was upset about the way the boys had spoken to her, I actually really felt for the boys.
Yeah.
I was like, you are growing up with a sort of toxic masculinity that you are just superior because you're boys.
Yeah.
And that is going to inhibit you in so many ways, especially as fathers.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to think some things are beneath you if this carries on. And that's a woman's place to do. And that's really not okay. And I felt really quite sad about it, but also glad that they then met a little girl who was like,
yeah.
yeah. No, that's not going to work for me. And I'm going to explain to you why this is not going to work for me. I felt really, really good because I, you know, especially the creative industries, I often meet women who are really sort of defining their own boundaries and defining their own achievements and goals, and they're setting them and they're doing them with less constriction than perhaps they felt in sort of more sort of mainstream, formal, however you want to word it, sort of workplace environments. And I know I've been speaking to a lot of women, a lot have come out of that because they just got so tired of being defined in a certain role that they wanted to be able to sort of push those boundaries a lot more. And you know, I feel really glad that I have that opportunity. But then also, you know, I spent the weekend with a surgeon who's, you know, one of the few women in her team, and you know, she's wow. really, you know, defining it in a workplace. And I'm like, you know, I feel like such a slacker when I meet women like that. Like, oh, I'm just helping, you know, do it in my own small way, but you are kicking butt and I appreciate that.
Going back to when you, so you worked in kind of mental health and in a more traditional role, I guess, what were the stumbling blocks for you? Like, when did you know, okay, I want to do something different, this isn't for me?
I think, I mean, part of it was, even though it was, you know, it wasn't even really a 9-to-5, I guess it was more like I was working for an employer, so it's more, you know, formal than I do now. I still didn't feel very grown up doing it, because I often, you know, my whole thing was I was a very creative person, and I worked with, you have to work in often quite different ways to really engage with certain families or certain children or certain adults. And so I felt like I was sort of in this place where I don't fit here. I'm struggling. I'm physically unwell. I'm really burnt out. I can't see me doing this for the rest of my life, simply because I can't see how I can sustain the level of energy. I'm a very passionate person who really wants to help as well, you know, and that's a huge thing in any of those kind of vocational roles, is like burnout comes really high. But then because of that, I was like, I can't see myself, what do I do? I think I tried to do several interviews going into sort of the charity sector right as the Conservative government came in, so you know, the charity sector was pretty much shut because, you know, it's like the worst time to try and make a career change, because I was like, maybe I can take the skills, you know, the kind of charities that were doing a lot of the outreach that I'd been, you know, trying to engage to help with, you know, families and children that I was working with. But I just couldn't see myself in an office. I was like, I don't fit here. I don't know how to be a grown-up, I guess. You know, my work life was often involved, like, a lot of either bodily fluids or being on the floor or being covered in paint, or, you know, that was kind of an average day. And yeah, there was a lot of paperwork and sitting at desks, but the desks were usually like in the janitor's cupboard or something, or a laptop that someone had found so I could fill out some urgent paperwork for a referral, and then someone would scream that one of the kids was climbing the walls and I'd have to go down and like deal with them. You know, that was kind of, so I didn't really know what to do. And then I actually got to the point that I was too physically ill to keep going to work. I was really run down and I was having hospital appointments all over the place. And in the meantime, the blog and the podcast were just taking off. Mm-hmm. And I went through a period of sort of unemployment where I just didn't feel honest to keep going to, you know, taking jobs and then not being able to fulfill what I was meant to turn up and do, because I was just so unwell. So I let a temporary contract just kind of die, really, because it was term time, and said, I don't think I'm coming back. And they were really keen for me to come back. I said, no, I don't know what to do, but I just don't feel like I need to heal. And I certainly wasn't in a financial position to do that, but I just was so ill. Mm. So while I was sort of convalescing, a couple of people were really supportive that sort of work in the sort of fibre industry, and we were chatting a lot, and they said, oh, just this blogging thing, can you monetize it? Of course, everyone says, like, oh, I'm not really sure if I'm interested in monetizing. I just don't know if that's for me. And then a few of them said, well, I'll pay you to host my blog for me. And I never have time to do it. I'm an independent, you know, business owner. And you just need to know what you're doing. And I just don't have time for that. Can I just brain dump at you and you host it? And I was like, yeah, no problem. It was kind of just a way of me getting back some, I guess, a bit of stamina around work again, because I was really unwell. And it kind of snowballed from there. I kind of picked it up as I went. So in terms of stumbling blocks, I think it's just that I didn't really have a plan.
Yeah.
I didn't really know where my place was and where to fit. It wasn't like I went, oh, I'm going to be a freelancer now. I really was quite a tumble. And I seemed to have quite an aptitude for social media, and that I was just curious about why people responded more to one thing than another.
Yeah.
And it grew from there, and I got quite interested, and, you know, I was like, this marketing thing seems kind of crazy, but I guess I could learn a bit about that if I'm writing someone's newsletter, you know, because people were asking me to write because I was a writer and take photographs because I was a photographer. Well, you know, an amateur one, of an enthusiast. And I think part of it maybe is that I didn't have a set of people around me for a long time who did that kind of work. I was kind of on my own for a while within this sort of fibre industry, which is where I started, because a lot of my blogging was about knitting, because that's what I liked doing. Yeah. You know, I was quite ill. And, it was learning patterns that I just had never been introduced to before. You know, my parents had 9-to-5. I mean, my mum initially didn't work to look after us, and then she actually went back to university. Well, she went back to college and she got some qualifications, so she felt that she could re-enter the workplace, because she'd come straight from school into work, and then she'd had us. And that was kind of my model, as you know, you get a good GCSE or something, and then you go to work. Like, it was a very, I come from quite a working class background, you know, they were factory workers, and that, you know, you got the best education that you could, but we couldn't afford you to go too far, and then, you know, you go and get a job. That was kind of the model, and the fact that I'd gone to university was kind of like this big thing. But when I was at university, I felt very out, like a fish out of water. There was a lot of people there who, it was a given that they were going to university, and I had no idea what I was doing. So I guess that was a theme. I think I've just sort of fumbled around for years, and I'm always amazed when I interview people for podcasts or I talk to people in the creative industry who just seemed to know, and it was something innate that they knew they were going to go and create this thing. I'm always particularly fascinated by those people. I'm like, wow, I could have saved so much time.
I am sometimes not cynical of that, but I sometimes think that that can come with hindsight. Like, there definitely are people that know and have the innate confidence, and the people around them that kind of help them, show them the way, and like, yes, I want to be this, I want to be that, you know. But I think sometimes it can be a bit of hindsight, because even I say now, oh, but I knew I wanted to be a journalist from the age of 5, which is true, I did, or I wanted to be a writer, I, you know, that was always my thing. But I only say that with hindsight, really. I did so much other stuff, so much other nonsense in the meantime.
And you try things on and you take some of those skills, you know, I would liken it to gardening, you know, one year, something that you lovingly nurtured for an entire 3 seasons doesn't produce the thing that you need it to produce. And you feel like it's such a huge failure and a waste, but actually you take that lesson into the next few seasons, and that's kind of the nature of it. And I kind of think careers are the same. You try things on, and there's so many things now that I'm like, oh, if I hadn't had that experience, I wouldn't now be able to. I really do believe that so much of like the sort of the empathy that I learned through the work I did really helps me with how I engage with people, both in terms of the, sort of the community around what I do, but the work I do and storytelling, and particularly when I'm employed to write copy for people. I'm sort of, I can really sort of dig into what it is that they want to convey. That empathy hasn't disappeared. You don't suddenly stop caring and listening and really thinking about someone's reaction to something. You just use it in a different way suddenly.
I think people sometimes worry a lot that the, you know, trying on, like you say, trying on different careers will hinder them and it will be a waste of time. But actually, you're so right. You've completely hit the nail on the head, that actually it will get you further, that you're never gonna, it's never a waste of time to try out that contract in social media, that because you're quite good at it, you don't know if you want to do that for the rest of your life. But if you do it for now, I mean, I'm a big believer in just saying yes and just doing it for now. Nothing is permanent.
No, and you can change direction at any time, because you're the person living your life. I think there is a slight, that's a slightly romantic view, I guess, because there is also the thing that it's a privilege to be able to do those things. It's something that I don't discredit, you know, I'm not sure if discredit's the word, but I often feel like I enjoyed a certain amount of privilege to be able to do it because the positions I was in at the time. There's a lot of people who those opportunities simply aren't open because they need their life to run a certain way. You know, I'm thinking particularly my friend at the moment, she's a single mum. There's not a great deal of money. She needs a lot of benefits to support her. She's finally going to university, and I'm so incredibly proud of her in a way that I don't want to sound patronizing, because I just want to like wake up every day and like just scream a high five down the phone. She's doing it, but she's juggling an awful lot of work and things to make it happen. And I think there's part of her that would just be exhausted if I said, yeah, but you're doing it and you're living your dream. She's like, oh, you know what? I just want to be able to provide for my kid. I think would be her answer. And it comes from a certain amount of stress being a person who has to be supported by benefits. I know that as a single parent, you know, it's demoralizing. And you do sometimes think, do you know what? I'm just going to take my life this way because I do not have to engage with HMRC. I really know what that feeling is like. Because do you know what? It's too hard. I'm done.
It is demoralizing. Just for having to sort out maternity leave as a self-employed person, I've never felt such a scrounger in my life. It's patriarchal, isn't it? It comes down to the patriarchy, because if men had to take this amount of time off, if they were the primary caregivers, as so often they aren't, then maternity leave would be completely different.
Yeah,
it would not be. We wouldn't have to beg for it.
No, and it's a thing that we have an entire system around, a very sort of capitalist society. You know, that we're going back to what we talked about, the schools, like kids go to work, they are like little drone bees. You know, that's your job, you go out and you become part of the machine, and that's the way things are set up. So our benefits are set up the same, and just making sure that's not going to ring again. But the thing is, with the way our benefit system is currently set up, is once you're on a benefits tier, it's incredibly hard to move off of it or within it. You know, often this sort of seems to be this assumption, you know, once you're unemployed, because I had that period of unemployment and I had to take, you know, sort of job seekers allowance and things. And those weekly meetings around job seekers, particularly when I was someone who was trying to either career change or to, you know, get some freelance work, the minute I took the freelance work, it negated any benefits, but the freelance work that I took was never going to be enough to pay my bills. So it's quite a punitive system that very quickly you can end up becoming more and more dependent on it. And then it becomes, you know, and then I had this whole period, you know, with the maternity, same thing again, like you felt quite penalized the minute you went back to work. There was kind of no easing. It's like you're in or you're out.
That's what I found.
It kind of keeps you a single mum. It's totally a cycle. I was a single mum who was self-employed, and I had an opportunity to grow. And I thought, if I grow and it does, you know, this is just a temporary bit of growth for me, I have to think about childcare. That would negate that benefit. And it's harsh. The second you misstep, if you're on working tax credits, it's gone.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's great, but I'm eating air until you review this. Yeah. And so, you know, you'd have 6 weeks of just sheer stress and dreading every letter that came through from HMRC. And that's a really horrible place to be in. Yeah. It's not people who perhaps have the strongest mental health who are on them. You know, I can hold my hand up with that and say, you're in quite a vulnerable place. And I often think, I did all this. I had all this work experience where I helped people sort their benefits out, and I've done degrees, and, you know, I would consider myself a pretty intelligent person and pretty self-sufficient. And I found this system hard. So, wow, we're expecting a lot from somebody who's more vulnerable than I am.
I didn't even think about it like that. Because I come from a real place of privilege. And especially, I think, being a parent, but not being a single parent, I cannot even comprehend how hard that must be. I think it takes a whole new level of emotional resilience, along with all the other practical sides of things.
Yeah, and I think there's quite a noble idea of it, you know, this sort of exhausting life as a single parent. I mean, you know, there's also great things, like I've defined my own boundaries and goals, and there's a lot of things that I could set out rhythms so that I could be self-employed in a way that I might have found more difficult. But then I would have had a partner, you know, who hopefully would have been helping share childcare and household things and finances. So it is, and I think there's a conversation that often people feel very, unwilling, because it makes it sound like that it's coming from a bad place, but it is a very difficult conversation to have. Is I can choose this creative journey because I have, you know, I have a certain amount of privilege, and privilege is something we do experience. Yeah. And people get quite angry when they hear the word, particularly when perhaps they're sort of realizing it for the first time.
Yeah.
And that's really normal. Like, if you, shame is a massive response, and if you don't feel shame, that you realize that you are in a much better position than someone else simply because you have, you know, you're white skinned, cisgendered, able-bodied, you know, any of those things. Yeah, that seems like normal to feel shame to me.
Yeah, it's a human reaction.
Be aware of it and do something about it. Yeah. You know, that's fine. It's okay to feel shame, but I think that can sometimes stop people from engaging in that conversation, which kind of important in the work and world that we're existing in, with sort of creativity and online and things.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's a level of defensiveness that sometimes I know it does for me as well. Also, I should just say, because only because I'm incredibly ignorant and I didn't used to know what cis meant. So that is the gender that you were born with. So so I am a cis female.
Yeah.
And if you were born as a man with male genitalia, then you're a cis man. So it's just how you identify yourself, and not excluding people who identify as male but weren't born that way, as in born with their genitalia that way. Yeah. That's right, isn't it? I always feel a bit sweaty palm
when
I say this,
because
I just don't want to be offensive. No. But
no, and I think it's okay. How do I put it? Like, as somebody, you know, who's in a same-sex relationship, I would far rather have people with the best intentions fumble around. Mm. You know, we had this lovely experience, actually, that meant a lot to us as a family. My daughter just started a new school, and her teacher was getting to know her, and she did this whole activity where everybody drew new name tags for their pegs, because she knew that my daughter would need one, so we should all do it. And I just thought I was really like, yes, I really like the way you've gone about this, making her feel included. And she's obviously sat drawing next to her, getting to know her. You know, I was like, good, you know, busy hands, get them talking. And she sort of delicately tried to work out whether it was two mummies. And my daughter thought this was hilarious when she came home. She said, she thinks I have two mummies. And obviously, like, to her, that's madness, because I have one mummy that I came out of her tummy. And I said, well, why do you think that she thinks you have two mummies? And, you know, we really, like, chatted about it, and it was lovely. But I loved that she hadn't just not said anything.
She hadn't avoided the topic.
But she also hadn't just assumed.
Yeah.
And it meant a huge amount to us. And I just felt like my daughter would be accepted, and that any, you know, because it's a very real thing, you know, I felt very suffocated in my last community, that I was very frightened that my daughter would be subject to bullying. You know, I felt like my little girl was equipped, but actually the school felt pretty equipped.
Yeah.
And, you know, just that gentle exploration meant a huge amount to me. But also, there is a thing that it's not someone's job to educate you. And that is a big bugbear of mine, that often people kind of want, particularly around sort of Black Lives Matter movement. Mm. You know, there's a lot of people like, it's not my job to educate you. Yeah. Step out of your privilege. Yeah. That can feel pretty, I know I can feel pretty exhausted sometimes when someone will kind of, a phrase that I hear a lot is like, in this day and age, when I talk about experiencing sort of homophobic responses. Perhaps I had one recently on Instagram, and someone was really like, in this day and age. I was like, wow, if you can say that, you're really not looking around enough. Like, you know, there are people still being killed when they come out by their families. Yeah. So that's, you know, yes, there's extreme examples, but there's also a lot of low level examples. Yeah. There's a reason that a lot of us in the LGBT community feel a lot safer in certain bars.
Yeah.
That's a very real thing.
So it's
and I like the online spaces that I've found that have where they're having those conversations, because it meant that I could learn what cisgendered means, yeah. and what does TERF mean, and, yeah. you know, and what is this privilege thing that everyone's talking about, mm. and why is my white privilege such a big thing, and what is white feminism, and oh god, I think that's me, and oh, I okay, right, I'm gonna work on this. And I did like huge reading topics and just kind of really dive down that rabbit hole that exists yeah. online. But I think we tend to only look at, there's, I mean, just Instagram, some of the values around the explore page I think is quite interesting, although my explore page I think I'm training quite well. Some of the things that are coming up recently, I'm like, you're getting to know me, Instagram. I high five it every time. There's a whole lot of rainbows going on here, Instagram, good job.
That's a really good point. You know, you do need to, if you don't like what you see on your explore page, and actually it's a bit of an analogy for life, then start training it so that you can so that yeah, you're seeing what you want to see.
Well, we exist in bubbles, you know, this yeah, has been
it's an echo chamber,
political yeah political discussions over the last few years. It's really kind of made people kind of, wow, I'm only talking to people who have the same opinion as me.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't perhaps only seeing things that look like me. That's yeah. a big thing too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's something that I've been really working on over the last couple of years on my social media, that my timeline now, it looks really varied on Twitter. I'm finding it a lot harder on Instagram.
I think it is harder, isn't it?
There's certain things I'm drawn very visually to certain things as yeah. well, is what I've realised. And it is a very visual medium. Yeah. So sometimes someone has some really interesting things to say in the caption, but you'll lose it if you're just looking at the images.
Yeah.
So I sort of had to train myself not to get sucked into, oh, that's a nice coffee image. Because coffee images are, you know, comforting.
They are. And it's okay if that's what you want to see. But yeah, it's important to know that there's other things out there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I do sometimes like deliberately go and fall down those rabbit holes and see where they take me. Sometimes, whoa, you go to a scary place, but and that stuff's there if you want to find it. But yeah, I do deliberately try and just dedicate a bit of time for just cruising around and yeah. and just getting out of my usual sort of well-worn paths, if you like. I think it's really opened up the world to me.
I think that Instagram, that's the key to enjoying Instagram, because mm-hmm. I have a Facebook group for the podcast, and it's quite small, and every Wednesday we do a weekly honesty thread where I basically mm-hmm. just say, it started out as me just saying, hey guys, this is how I feel this week, and then right. it just had a huge response, because if you're vulnerable, people feel like they can be vulnerable too, and it's become a really nice safe environment to share. Oh my god. But you know, it's all around, mostly around blogging and but a lot that comes up is people feeling really crappy about Instagram, and just feeling a bit crap about it, like, you know, either their own profile, it doesn't look how they want, or they don't feel good when they log in, they don't feel like they're spending enough time on it, or they feel like they're spending too much time on it. And for me, I think the whole thing around Instagram is just to kind of have fun and get lost down rabbit holes. I remember Sarah Tasker encouraging, get lost in a hashtag rabbit hole. Start off with one hashtag and just keep going.
Yeah, that's great advice.
It's so good, isn't it? Because you discover.
She should think about doing e-courses or something, that girl, because she knows what she's talking about, right?
Oh, maybe I'll suggest it to her.
Yeah, she seems like she's got time.
I hear she's kind of big on
Instagram. I've got a lot of time for Sarah. Yeah, yeah, I hear she's a bit of a queen or something. Got a lot of time for Sarah. She talks sense.
She talks so much sense. And that was probably one of my greatest takeaways for Instagram and enjoying it. Go to get lost down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. And she's one of those people that she's very self-aware in what she's doing. So there's some people I don't know if I could always take the kind of content she shares. Not, I don't mean that in a negative way, in that, you know, she's the beautiful images, and she's very beautiful, a child's beautiful, and you know, it's just
she has this
very whimsical thing, but she's so self-aware in it, and she's very, I love her captions, and the number of times she's genuinely made me laugh out loud, and her writing's beautiful too. You know, she's very evocative, and then her advice is very practical and able to use, and she's not someone who's got this huge platform and said, oh, but I'm not going to be political for fear I lose followers. I have a lot of time for people who do that. So I have a lot of time for that kind of, you know, presence on the internet as a result. I'm like, yeah, go do your thing, be creative and share that dream and really inspire people. But there's heart and soul behind it, and there's a realness, and there's a great self-awareness that doesn't make me feel threatened and feel bad when I look. And I think that's a really important thing, is I think sometimes we can be chasing inspiration. Oh, these people are wonderful and beautiful, and everything's wonderful and beautiful, and suddenly you're not feeling wonderful and beautiful anymore because it's not relating to real life. Mm. And you need something that just tethers you, maybe.
Yeah. That's a really good way of putting it. The tethering often comes in, for Sarah in the captions.
Mm-hmm.
And you it's a trust thing, isn't it? You trust that.
Absolutely.
That isn't her life every day. That's for Instagram, and that's fine. And
I've been lucky enough to meet her a couple of times, that she's the same person. Like, that is who she is. And I've because of the kind of work I do, I often meet people, you know, who've got big profiles and things, and it's always so nice when you meet someone who is the same person. I mean, it's, you know, we're all putting our best foot forward online. You have to remember not to judge your middle by someone else's best.
Sure.
But it's really disconcerting sometimes when you meet someone who is completely different to how you seem online. And I'm always, it kind of, it's really jarring. And I often feel that's the negative side. And that's where I suspect they probably don't like how different it is. Or maybe they do, it's escapism. There is a thing about creating who you want to be, I guess, which I've done before, you know, I wasn't.
But it's exhausting, isn't it? I think exhausting. I don't think you can enjoy that long term. I think you can enjoy it for, I don't know, 10 minutes, 2 weeks, be like, oh, this is great, this is the person I always wanted to be. But then suddenly you have to keep it up, and that feels gross.
Yeah, I think it's hard. And I think for me, I practiced slowly drip feeding sort of coming out online before I did in my real life. I think that's a really, I think a lot of people do, they sort of practice maybe being the best part of themselves that they're not brave enough to be in real life, and sometimes it gives them that push. And I'm a big fan of that. I'm like, oh, I don't tear someone down for trying, you know. That's the equivalent of someone, you know, trying to introduce themselves at a party and you're saying, oh, you know, you didn't seem real enough to me. I mean, we'd never do that, would we? So when I hear people tearing others down, I'm like, you'd never do that in person.
I know, it's so true.
You just don't seem authentic enough to me right now. Just come on. Is that really how we treat people?
But yes, you're right. It reminds me of an episode of the Adam Buxton podcast I was listening to with him, and I think it was Joe Cornish, the Christmas one that they do every year. And they were giving each other presents, and they were saying, if this was Twitter, because they didn't like each other's presents, but if this was Twitter, there'd be no pleasantries. It'd be like, God, did you get that for free? Are you sponsored by the brand? Try harder.
I quite enjoy the humour that Twitter has. And again, like, I'm a big fan of, you know, unfollow if you think it's a hate follow. Don't put yourself through that, because actually you and the person you're following deserve better. And use the mute button to protect your mental health if you need, you know. I'm a big fan of, you know, looking after yourself, but I find Twitter has a much better sense of humor than Instagram, so I spend quite a lot of time on it. And I particularly enjoyed around Christmas, you know, and there was like this dad who was like, you know, I have a millennial coming to stay, so he'll just be tweeting hilarious things hoping it goes viral for next week. And I was like, this is so true.
I think I also love Twitter, but yeah, unfollow or mute if you feel like you need to protect yourself, because that's the most important thing.
Or move around and share people on different platforms. There's people that I felt really bad unfollowing on Instagram because I didn't like their voice on Instagram, but I loved them on Twitter. Or I was on their newsletter and I was getting the thing that I needed. I did a big thing where I realized that, you know, newsletters were taking over every inbox that I had, and I did a big cull. Some I realized I had on three. I clearly very much cared about that person's content. Maybe I don't need them on all three, and then felt really obliged to tell lots of people, like, I unfollowed you, but not because I dislike what you're doing anymore. And I think we can get quite hung up that everyone is sat watching, waiting for who's unfollowing. And I mean, I don't pay attention. Maybe other people do more, but I try to not get too much into that numbers game. But I guess, you know, for some people who are really trying to cultivate a business, they might do. But
Which is, know, yeah,
that
totally
seems like
fine,
the path of bad mental health.
Yeah,
to me.
I agree. I think it's totally fine. I understand when people have a goal, but I really always encourage understanding what the goal is before, because a lot of the time it's just an ego thing, isn't it? You get to your number that you've set as an arbitrary goal, like 10,000, so you have your swipe up, and then you're like, oh. Yeah. Okay, yeah. What do I do now?
Yeah, my breakfast don't look better for me to Instagram, weirdly. Like, there was not some magical path and I suddenly live in an all-white living room, you know? Like,
so
I'm not
true.
That Instagrammer now. That doesn't work that way. And I just think it's never going to be enough if the numbers is the target, because you'll hit 10, you'll be like, yeah. I got my swipe up. Okay, now I want 20. Now yeah. I want to be that Instagrammer. And I think, and again, I think we can often look at other people who are at those figures and think that they're not working as hard as everybody else, yeah. because they've made it, or they, you know, they've got everything they need, and often those people are still working really hard, and they're, you know, they're still having a different set of issues maybe, or the same set of issues,
of course,
you know.
I
think it's, and there's a lot of people who have very quietly set up brand new accounts that they just go and play on and enjoy themselves, and they don't particularly talk about, and I love it when I stumble across them. So I'm like, oh, that kind of has so-and-so's tone. I'm like, oh, I see what you did there. Because they just want it with the pressure off, and
yeah,
I can totally relate to that. I think that's great.
I think that's a really good message for everybody, just have a play, which is
yeah,
whole
I
thing.
Think so. Yeah, and I think that's often, you know, I thought about, oh, do I need to change playful day? It doesn't sound very grown up, but I think that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
It's, we can sometimes just get really bogged down. I'm always slightly, I find it amusing when people really want me for business advice, and they sort of really, what's the secret? And I'm like, I don't know if I'm the right person for you, but I do know a series of excellent coaches I can recommend. I'm not really sure. Just have fun and be engaged with the community. Remember, it's called a social network. You're meant to be social on it. You know, like, all those, the clues are there. Don't forget that there's real people on the other side. You know, it's not a performance. You know, like, good luck.
I think these are all excellent pieces of advice, and you should probably write an e-course now.
I don't think I'm an e-course person. I had so much admiration for people who do them, and I think they're so great for, like, access to, you know, a lot of people who might not be able to get the opportunity to have, you know, that kind of stuff in their lives. But I'm not built that way, I don't think. Quite happy with my camera and scuttling around.
On that note, where can everybody find you online, and what are your projects this year that you want to talk about?
So you can find me as at A Playful Day on Pinterest, Twitter, Instagram, and I have a Facebook page that I occasionally remember exists and have a little flurry and then I don't. I am at aplayfulday.com, and if you go /podcast, you can listen to the podcast. There's all the archives there, and there's some amazing interviews. And I have a blog which varies wildly what I'm talking about. And I actually also should, I'm not very good at talking about it, 'cause I'm not very good at asking people to pay us for our content, but I host a lot of content on Patreon. It's a crowdfunder that basically, you know, people can subscribe every month at different tiers to fund what you're doing. So some people pay for extra podcast content, some people pay for extra blogs, some people pay for a sort of live hangout. There's all kinds of things I'm still sort of finding my comfort zone with, because yeah. I still find it really odd. I tried the sponsorship route and it didn't work for me, so that's something I recently sort of rebooted, if you like. I took a year off, I took an online gap year, which I, if you're in the position to do, I can thoroughly recommend, because I left a lot of hang-ups behind around what my numbers should be. And so it means that 2018, I'm going in with, I'm going to use Patreon to fund what I do, because I want to do more writing and I want to do more podcasts and I want to do a lot more around visibility and representation. And I think that's what sort of 2018 is looking about, is how I then grow a lot of different voices on A Playful Day, and how I fund that so it becomes a meaningful piece of work for me. Because I was working full time as a brand manager, the most bizarre thing that came out from doing this sort of online blogging and podcasting thing, is then people wanted to employ me to do it for their brand, which I resisted for a long time. And then actually I ended up working for a yarn company who I loved, and I've been able to really push my photography and writing with them, and I was doing campaigns and all sorts, but I needed to step back in order to move. So now I'm doing freelance. And again, I sound like I'm quite reactive all the time in the way that I work, but I do try to be. I'm getting a lot of requests from people who are sort of looking for more documentary style photography and more representative photography. I've had a lot of same-sex families contact me for photo shoots because they didn't feel perhaps the sort of more straight photographers in their area were giving them what they needed.
Yeah.
They didn't feel seen. So I'm going to be working on that portfolio.
That's hugely exciting.
It is. Yeah. I'm really excited about it. It's the first time I've kind of said it in public, I guess. That's what I've been quietly working on. So yeah, that's kind of, I guess, where I am. It's just working on getting more writing. I was writing a lot of editorials in places a few years ago, and I stopped just because, you know, it's not the kind of publishing cycle often for online is very fast, and it's not conducive when you're a single parent with limited childcare. It's like, well, I need to do a rewrite at 2 o'clock. It's like, well, actually, I've got to go on the school run.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Sorry, I know it's meant to be in for tomorrow, but... So I think working on that more is definitely a big thing, because, I've been very lucky that over the last year, I took a year out, I came back, and when I came back, I made the very conscious decision to be out and visibly out, because I felt I couldn't be, because I didn't see people like me. Mm. And now that I'm there, I kind of want to really use that and just write about that experience, because I know that people enjoy my writing, and it matters. Stuff really matters to me, so that's what I'm going to work on this year, to do it in a hopefully structured way.
I am so excited to follow along.
Ah,
I could literally talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but I'll let you go. Thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Oh, thank you. It's been a really nice experience.
Oh, good. It's been a joy to chat to you. Thanks for listening to What She Said. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and if you did, please think about leaving me a 5-star rating and a review if you have time. This really helps other people find the podcast and means that Apple don't hide me in their vaults. If you fancy joining my small but perfectly formed bunch of podcast fans for chit chat on Facebook, head to facebook.com/groups/whatshesaidpodcast and come and join us.